Hello and welcome to the January 19th, 2024 edition of Ukraine Without Hype, the first episode of the new year. We just got through the holiday season. Wasn't so great for me recovering from COVID, but I don't know. Romeo, how are you doing? I saw that actually a missile attack got pretty near you. So how does that factor into your holidays?
Not the best. I didn't have too much of holidays since I've been basically working nonstop since New Year's. So beyond the accumulated fatigue, otherwise fine. The missile strike was like across the train tracks from my apartment. So like within 2 kilometers of me, which is far too close, but nothing was damaged, thankfully. Unfortunately, it's something to be expected given that I live in the suburbs.
Yeah, I think that's the first thing we should really talk about is we had begun to talk about it in the last episode, the New Year's episode, because this Russian missile campaign really began at the tail end of December. Went pretty hard for the opening about week or two of January. In Kyiv, it seems to have largely petered out. We have not really gotten anything too recently, or anything too big too recently, I should say. Though it very much continues in Kharkiv, especially, seems to be getting more and more missile attacks, including yet another hotel that is, you know, a journalist / NGO hotel in Kharkiv was once again destroyed, bringing the number of those uncomfortably high, and reminder of my policy that when I travel, do not stay at the journalist hotels because Russia purposely targets and destroys them.
They actually admitted it to directly targeting the latest one. They claimed it was in revenge for Ukraine targeting a analogous kind of hotel in Donetsk, I believe.
Yeah, something like that. Russia has been really trying to push this narrative of them only doing reprisals. They really began this narrative right before and in the early stages of the current campaign, where they're saying, oh, they're just replying to Ukrainian attacks, including one Ukrainian attack that was aimed at various sites near Belgorod. These missiles were shot down over Belgorod. Of course, in the past, when Ukraine has struck targets in Belgorod before, Russia has really, really played it down to make it look like, you know, it's no big deal, because they don't want people in Russia to actually feel the effects of the war coming home. But this time around, after the most recent attacks in the Belgorod region, they have really been pushing, look at the terrorism that the Ukrainians have been doing. So that's a slight change in the Russian narrative. Mostly, I think it was because Ukraine brought Russia to a UN general, or to a UN Security Council meeting, asking them to respond and investigate, etc. And they wanted their own turn to do the same thing back to Ukraine. And that's really, I think, the main reason why they did that, especially since they've already kind of stopped talking about it. If this was such a grave thing to Russia, maybe they could have kept their attention on it for longer than like 4 days.
But I will say to your earlier point that the Russian narrative is changing. I think we can see this because it's getting harder for Russians to ignore the fact that there's war. Lots of Moscow Oblast, for example, is freezing. It's been a huge scandal over in Russia that their failing infrastructure is completely collapsing. People have lived in like negative 10, 15, 20 degree weather without any heating right outside of Moscow. So it's not surprising that the Kremlin is trying to drum up active support for the war now that it's getting very hard to ignore its effects in Russia.
Yeah, that kind of confused me, what's happening in Russia right now. Well, overall, what's happening is that there is a very, very big cold snap going on in most of European continent Russia at the moment. And it has led to pipes freezing over and bursting. And part of the explanation is that there just hasn't been maintenance on a lot of these pipes for a very long time. This is partially explained by the fact that a lot of the maintenance men have been drafted and sent to Ukraine, but it apparently goes much, much further back than that. And I mean, there are, of course, big differences between Ukraine and Russia, but I thought on this front, it would be more similar because the whole point of, well, in Ukraine, what happens is that basically hot water is turned off for weeks at a time for maintenance purposes. And the same thing happens in Russia. I know this from, you know, Russian friends and all that. The same thing happens in Russia that they have to turn off the water for maintenance purposes. And the thing is, in Ukraine, I guess they actually do maintenance, and in Russia, they don't.
So a big part of that particular issue is that the maintenance budget since 2022 has been significantly cut, and that money has been redirected to the military industrial complex. Actually, I think in general, the reorganization of the Russian economy towards not quite total war, but to a more overarching war footing is under discussed. But when you reduce the maintenance budget, what happens is not that people make do with less. Russia is incredibly corrupt. I think it'll shock no one to learn that the maintenance budget is largely skimmed by local authorities, because the maintenance budget is one of the few areas where local authorities have direct access to the pocketbooks. So when you reduce the maintenance budget, you do not reduce the amount that is stolen from the maintenance budget. You reduce the amount that is left over after being stolen. That on top of the conscription efforts that have seen large amounts of these working class and blue collar Russians being drafted has resulted in what we see now, a kind of apocalyptic situation, I guess, if you're living in a Moscow suburb.
Yeah, and of course, it leads to cascading effects. Once one heating station goes down, once one pipe bursts, it puts more pressure on everything else. And it's been going pretty rough for them there. Of course, no crocodile tears to shed over that.
Fuck around, find out.
Yeah, seriously. And the last thing I'd like to say is, I did intend to go to Chernivtsi to celebrate the old new year of Malanka. Unfortunately, I was not able to do that because of my health situation. It was interesting that the thesis that I wanted to go there with, and I'll just say that now since I couldn't do it properly, was that this year was the first year that Ukraine had kind of fully shifted to the Gregorian calendar, the calendar that everyone's used to, as opposed
in
to
the decadent West.
In the decadent West that corrected the calendar back in the Middle Ages to not be wrong anymore, as opposed to the Julian calendar, which was historically used by the Orthodox Church. And this move was mostly done to separate Ukraine from Russia. Christmas this year was largely celebrated on December 25th, as opposed to in early January, which is according to the Julian calendar. So I kind of wanted to go there to see the old new year because it is already, you know, baked into the name of it, which is that it's the old new year as opposed to the new year. So I wanted to kind of see if people were treating the calendar changing differently in that context. I had seen some Malanka type celebrations used on December 31st / January 1st. But also I wanted to go to Chernivtsi for it because this was for the Romanian minority, which is quite large in the region, who treats Old New Year much more seriously and probably doesn't associate the Julian calendar with Russia as opposed to Romania. So I don't know. That's the idea that had going to my head. Could not follow through with it because of COVID. But anyway, moving on to the news of this past 2 weeks, really, or almost three since our last update on the new year. We'll be going over some of the combat updates, not too many of them. The news out of the U.S. regarding Congress support or, of course, non-support for Ukraine, the death of a Russian propagandist, and then the real meat of the episode will be discussing the mobilization bill, topics around what we kind of discussed in the end of last year, talking about what one of the problems would be mobilization and what steps have been taken this year to solve that, and they are very, very messy. And then some shorter topics with some protests in Bashkortostan, Russia, as well as a big New Year prisoner exchange that took place. So without further ado, into the combat update. Like I said, very little has actually evolved on the front line. This is, of course, moving into this defensive war that we discussed. But if we even look at Avdiivka and other parts of the front line that Russia has been doing its offensive on for the past, since October now, in earnest, and really in the past month, there's no changes. I'm sure if you really zoom in down to the meter by meter level, if you're really following it super closely with all the open source intelligence and drone videos and all that, you can see that, you know, this shed was taken, that tree line was lost. But in the macro sense, these add up to such little exchange of territory that the overall story is that Russia has been completely trapped in this offensive with basically nothing happening on their end for the past month. And if you add it all up for the past 3-4 months, still very little. So as much doomsaying is talking about, you know, Russian offensives, and there always is a lot of pessimism about them, really, they've accomplished nothing. City of Avdiivka, as we've been discussing, it's being battered very, very severely. The fact that nothing is changing hands does not mean that these are not some of the most brutal battles of the entire war happening right now in terms of losses, especially on the Russian side. But overall, not much update to really say there. But one big military win that has occurred recently was on January 14th, an A-50 aircraft. This is a Russian aircraft that handles radar, often handled by very skilled technicians, often accompanied by high-level officers.
It's comparable to the U.S. AWACS aircrafts. So if you've ever seen pictures of those big military planes with a stupid-looking disc on top, that's the kind of plane we're talking about. These are very rare, very expensive, incredibly specialized, and usually not placed anywhere near the front.
Yeah, there's only about a half dozen of these things. There is a theory of how this plane was able to be shot down. That's still only a theory. That basically beforehand, Ukraine had targeted radar stations in occupied territory, blew up a bunch of radar stations with missile strikes, meaning that this A-50 was required to come in and fill in the gaps left behind by the missing ground-based radar and other detection systems, where it was then drawn into this area of low radar coverage. It was attacked by maybe a Patriot missile, but of course, this is all very secretive. But of course, this was a very elaborate trap. This is the first time that ever such a plane was shot down out of the sky. They have been damaged on the ground before, but the fact that it is covered to head to toe with, you know, the most advanced detecting systems on the planet means that they're pretty hard to shoot down. But it was done. Ukrainians figure it out.
Historical first, and it wasn't just the A-50 that was shot down. A airborne control post was also heavily damaged. It did manage to limp its way back to Russia, but from pictures, we can see that the entire plane is just utterly peppered with shrapnel, and it's not entirely clear whether the plane can be repaired and made airworthy again, or if it's simply out of commission.
Very, very big a win right there. But also talking about electronic warfare in general, there have been a lot of problems in the Baltic Sea recently. We're talking the end of last year and the beginning of this one, of there just being basically blackouts or brownouts of GPS systems in the Baltic Sea. This, I guess, if you're not aware of what the Baltic Sea is, it's the one that starts at Denmark and ends at St. Petersburg. A lot of ships in this area have reported that their navigation systems have been having a lot of problems. And through open source intelligence, people have basically traced where these blackouts and brownouts have gone to Kaliningrad Oblast of Russia, the part of Russia that kind of, it's an enclave of Russia, basically stuck between Poland and Lithuania. Obviously, this is where this is coming from. Kaliningrad is essentially a military base in order to cause problems in the Baltic Sea. It is very heavily militarized, though less so now because of all the heavy losses that were taken from the Kaliningrad garrison. And the Russians must have placed these electronic warfare devices within Kaliningrad and, well, they've been turning them on recently. This has also become a problem in northern Poland, where GPS went out of whack in the previous few days. And this really raises the question of Russia is going to be doing more of against actual, EU NATO targets, especially in the near future. There's not a great way to counteract this right now without more aggressive stance against Russia. One good way to do it is to simply blow up the device in Kaliningrad, although that would spark World War III. So maybe
Königsberg back to Germany, I'd say.
My guess is to kind of remake the pagan Baltic Russians. Just there's not any of them left, but if all the Russians there can just pretend to be Baltic pagans again, I think that's one solution.
I would also like to note that on the topic of the Baltics and that general area, anecdotally, what I've seen from people in Sweden and Finland especially is that their governments are really harping on the imminent war thing for whatever reason. Especially the Finnish government has lately been very strongly hinting that Russia may invade, which seems absurd to me, to be honest. But that seems to be a very big thing of military preparedness in that area. Of course, the Baltic nations have been crowing about Russia invading them forever. And for that, they have far more evidence, including, Russian officials literally saying we want to reconquer the Baltics. So their paranoia is understandable. But the Finnish and the Swedish governments have also been joining that parade. Maybe they know something we don't, though. From my vantage point, it seems very unlikely that Russia will decide to launch an attack on Finland again.
Yeah, Sweden has as well. The Swedish government has been really kind of switching to a defensive war footing, at least rhetorically. If not nothing else, it seems like the Baltic, like the greater Baltic states, not just Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, are extremely concerned with Russian activity in the region. And there's probably not nothing to that. We already have, like I said, this electronic warfare going on. Will it escalate beyond that? We'll see. They seem to think that it's at least a credible threat. Moving on to the U.S., and this, I think, is a catastrophe, possibly the biggest catastrophe in at least international diplomatic sphere of the entire war, which is that when we were closing out the year, we were talking about how the Republican Party had decided to condition Ukraine aid on anything getting done about the southern border. They had a list of demands. We want you to do this in exchange for giving Ukraine aid. In my analysis of it, I said that the Republican demands, which the Democrats were very open to at minimum, and it looks like they're just going to take them in wholesale. I was saying how this is basically a poison pill. By accepting the Republican position, the Democrats were going to basically kill a lot of their support from the left of center of the United States, or at least sap away a lot of the energy. And that's all these elections are about, is about energizing your base and don't really win people over anymore. Well, it turns out that the Republicans weren't interested in doing it either. They came back from their holiday vacation and gave basically two conditions. One, still, Ukraine aid will not happen until their demands on the southern border are met. And step two, they will not do anything about the southern border. They will not vote on a compromise bill. They will not even put their own bill forward for the Democrats to accept until the Republicans once again control the White House. Speaker Johnson said this himself. This is not just the rantings of the lunatic MAGA fringe. This was coming from the House leadership. There is a Senate bill to fund Ukraine, supported by the Senate Republicans, but the House Republicans are saying, no, we are not accepting that. We want Trump in the White House before we can do anything. And ultimately, this is likely how it's going to be for most topics in the U.S., is that the House Republicans are probably just going to say no and no and no and buy time in order to kind of make people frustrated enough at government for not getting anything done that they want there to be a different government and vote for Trump as opposed to Biden. But as that comes down to Ukraine, is that no aid, no military aid until 2025.
And I just really want to stress this particular point, that the GOP does not give a flying fuck about the border or border security or immigration. They do not care. This issue is only a culture war shibboleth for them to bash the Democrats with. That is it. Whenever they are given the opportunity, like the Democrats have given them the opportunity to make changes to the immigration border policies of the United States, they do not take that because they don't care. Economically, much of their base survives purely to unregistered illegal labor migrants. That's where they get their workers. Like the construction companies and the big agri firms are not owned by Democrats or aligned with Democrats. You can look at their donation histories to see. And those are the biggest employers and the biggest reason for migration in the United States. They don't care. It's not anything but a rhetorical device for them.
And like I was saying, the Democrats were about to accept the Republican proposal pretty much wholesale just to get it out of the way. And they still said no. It is so plainly obvious that any defense of it, you can't defend it rationally. There is only the rhetoric. There is only the rhetoric that is there to basically sink American democracy as a whole and to deny Ukraine the help it desperately needs to survive, especially as we go, like we've discussed, into this war of attrition stage where every bullet counts, every artillery shell counts, every vehicle counts. And the Republicans, some of them are just doing it for this political play. Some of them are just don't especially care about Ukraine either way, or at least say to themselves that they support Ukraine, but it's the Democrats, the bad Democrats, who are refusing to do politics in order to make it happen, which is what, you know, McConnell and a lot of the Senate Republicans especially were trying to frame this as. And others in the more MAGA nationalist conservative side of things just genuinely hate Ukraine and want Ukraine to be destroyed, and they want the rise of Russia as a reactionary force that they can emulate in the United States. However, which one an individual Republican is doesn't especially matter because the result is the same. They're working to the same end. And as always, I'm very frustrated that the Ukrainian American community still largely votes Republican.
Again, anecdotally, from what I've heard from people who work on lobbying the Ukrainian American community, is they are simply not that invested in the war, which is hard to believe. But these are people who actively and regularly lobby and speak to this community, and it seems that these U.S. culture war issues are more important than ensuring their homeland doesn't get genocided.
That's one of those topics I want to delve into, but I have no idea how to do so, especially from all the way over here in Ukraine. And of course, anyone who is more actively engaged in the Ukrainian community is unlikely to want to disparage it very much. So I don't expect anyone to, you know, come onto this podcast and say that they're all a bunch of sellouts or something, because that'd be a very mean thing to do, especially if you depend on finding what support does exist. But from this end, it is one of the more frustrating things about this. I'm sure this story on U.S. funding will develop in some way. We are starting to see pushback within parts of the party in order to do literally anything. Can the Republicans sandbag for literally an entire calendar year? I think yes, but we'll see if they can pull that off. So we'll be watching this space, as always, very, very closely. This is a depressing story, and the topic after it will be another depressing story. So here's a light appetizer in order to help things out a bit. And that is the unfortunate end of enemy of the pod, Coach Red Pill, a.k.a. Gonzalo Lira.
Coach Dead Pill.
Actually stole that from one of my editors.
But yeah, Gonzalo Lira is dead. So for those of you who don't know, and may your lives be continuously blessed as it has been, Gonzalo Lira was a pickup artist coach who'd moved to Ukraine a few years ago. With the explicit and stated intention of taking advantage of poor Ukrainian women. That is quite literally the entire reason that he moved here. Somehow he got married. He lived in Kharkiv, even had a kid, which is, it really raises a lot of questions. But in any case, he pivoted to pro-Russian content with the outbreak of the full-scale war, still living in Kharkiv, mind you. Like, he was still living in Ukraine.
He was being bombed.
Yeah, he's literally being bombed on a daily basis. And yet he continued to put out these pro-Russian stories, talking about how Kharkivans feel Russia as their brother, and it's the awful Western Ukrainian Nazis that have fomented this war, and blah, 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 all the usual Russian apologia propaganda crap. Eventually, the Ukrainian government cottoned on and charged him with propaganda, or specifically with spreading defamatory materials about the state during martial law, which, as you can imagine, is very illegal. When a country is under martial law, you aren't really allowed to spread the propaganda of the enemy. That is not a First Amendment issue. That is a war issue. But he was he attempted to leave the country last year at the end of July.
You're missing some steps. You're missing some steps here, which make it even funnier. First, he was basically just asked to leave.
Oh, was he really?
Yeah. This was his actually second time being arrested, where his main story starts. And while he was in detention for the second time, he was basically put out on parole. The way I and most people interpreted it was that they were opening the door for him to just leave the country on his own, as long as he didn't make a big deal out of it. So what did he do? He made a big deal out of it.
He talked about his criminal way to smuggle himself across the border on social media.
He live streamed himself going on the lam. And here's the thing with how a lot of Ukrainian law enforcement and laws work. In most cases, if you don't make a big deal out of things, they kind of let it drop more often than not. They, especially now when they have more important things to worry about. However, he decided to force their hand by broadcasting him doing a crime all over the internet. So, of course, when he got to the Ukrainian border, they said, well, no, we can't let you actually jump bail right now after you told everyone in the world that's what you're doing. If you had just not told anyone, this would have worked. So, because he is a glory hound, he got arrested again, put back into jail, where some of his various health problems occurred. Now, where do these health problems go from? Well, every single video and picture of Coach Red Pill Gonzalo Rira includes him smoking. Every single one. I have never seen this man without a cigarette in his hand.
And mind you, he has never looked like a healthy individual. I understand this is a audio-based medium podcasting, but you can Google his face. He's a media figure. There's plenty of images. He has never once in his life looked anything like anything resembling healthy. The man did not take care of himself, likely because his brains were too clogged up with misogyny. You heard it here, folks. Misogyny causes health problems. Don't be a misogynist.
So yeah, dude smokes, just chain smokes all the time. Everything about him looks like he's about to keel over at any moment. And when entered into a prison, it didn't get any better. So he eventually died of what was probably lung disease of some variety or another. This was then turned into a huge cause célèbre of how dare the Ukrainians The Ukrainian Nazis kill a dissenting journalist. They assassinated him. They killed him. They executed him for his free speech.
Yes, he was a quote-unquote Zelensky critic.
A Zelensky critic who was taking photographs of Ukrainian military positions to be handed over to the Russians, and general propaganda on top of that. Don't do this. Just don't do this. In Ukraine or any other country, don't do espionage, and you'll probably be fine. Don't smoke constantly and then be surprised when there's lung and other health problems. And again, by constantly, I mean never not smoking.
All right, but counterpoint, smoking makes you look cool?
Gonzalo Lira has never looked cool in his entire life.
That's true. It did not help him.
Don't have that stupid haircut. We are tap dancing on his grave.
I mean, you have to understand, this man was trash. He not only was his audience full of incels, one of the most virulently misogynistic and hateful subcultures in the United States, but he actively courted them.
He was also a hardcore anti-Semite. He was
an anti-vaxxer. Like every single grift you can think of, Lira was on it. This was not a good man.
So now, of course, Tucker Carlson, the whole MAGA, stepping up to defend.
Hell, Elon Musk chipped in.
Elon Musk stepping up to defend this sex offender spy, which really just degrades them. Not that they have any dignity to lose anymore, but by associating themselves with a guy who has sexually assaulted many women, including his wife, who has made a career off of telling people that going to economically disadvantaged countries, finding vulnerable women and assaulting them is a rad and cool way to live before eventually ending up as a spy. Is that your hero? Is that who you're modeling yourself off of? I mean, the answer is yes. They love that stuff. They're all misogynists and sex offenders themselves most of the time, but really just highlighting it in the most grotesque way possible, like a comedic over-exaggeration of that type of guy. But yeah, he's dead now. Problem solved.
All the wages of sin, my friend. Moving on to our main topic of the week and what will probably remain a heated issue here in Ukraine for weeks and months to come is mobilization. Or for those of our audience who may not be familiar with the term, it's more commonly referred to as conscription in the West. So the Ukrainian government has been attempting to shore up the staffing of the military since basically the start of the full-scale war. The beginning, this issue was less apparent because there were a large number of volunteers who immediately enlisted in the military, and they were able to fill in and stop gap personnel shortages in the military. However, as time went on, about a year after the war, these issues with conscription began to crop up. Specifically, most people don't want to be drafted. I think this is not a controversial thing to note, that most people don't want to die in war. In fact, they actively try and avoid it. It's one of the reasons that martial law prevents men from the ages of 18 to 60 from leaving the country, specifically because most or a significant amount of people would. However, the methods that Ukraine's typical conscription system used to entice or even press gang people into the military caused a lot of scandals in Ukrainian society. As you can imagine, there are countless stories of people being snatched off the street and pressed into paddy wagons and driven to the conscription center, etc., etc. And a lot of these stories are, of course, overblown. However, there are plenty of these tales that are, in fact, sourced. Videos of officials from conscription centers literally shoving men into minivans and driving them off God knows where. As a result, in August, the conscription system had basically completely collapsed. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky actually made the very unprecedented step of straight up firing every single head of all of the regional military recruitment centers. And because, quite frankly, they were incredibly corrupt. There were endless, in addition to all the stories of people being press ganged, there were endless stories of selling exemptions was incredibly, incredibly popular. There were investigative journalism reports on conscription center heads buying villas in Spain in the middle of the war. I wonder where they got the money. So the whole process was quite simply fucked. Zelensky fired all the heads and appointed active duty military officials to replace them. But this did not seem to really solve the issue. It seemed like the system as a whole was run, which is not surprising since it was functioning with an unbroken chain of succession from the Soviet Union, and all of the people employed at these centers had been serving since those centers were recruiting for the Red Army. So this came to the topic of mobilization reform. And again, incredibly unpopular topic. No one wants to be drafted. It's kind of a political poison pill, or at least that's how most politicians in Ukraine see it. But something had to be done. So the cabinet, working together with the Committee on National Security, the Parliamentary Committee on National Security, finally put forward a draft bill in, I believe, early December. And that draft bill was immediately criticized by basically everyone. It had a lot of questionable or outright corrupt provisions. There were proposals to weigh the conscription lottery in favor of people who paid more tax. There were giant holes for corruption where recruitment center officials had incredible latitude in issuing draft notices. Basically, lots and lots of problems. The bill did not make it through committee. It was withdrawn for revisions. And that those revisions, every time a revised version of the bill comes out, those revisions are again criticized. It's going to be a real hard slog to get any sort of conscription reform passed. And it's not entirely clear that any bill that is passed will actually be an improvement over the current system. The military said last year, or specifically Top General Valery Zaluzhny said last year, that Ukraine is looking to expand the military by about 500,000 people, 500,000 people. That is quite a lot. And obviously, it cannot do that with the current conscription system. It's impossible to do that. So this bill will need to be passed in order to make any dreams of expanding the military a reality. And on top of that, there's been increasing discontent from frontline soldiers as well, who have noted that some of them have been on the front lines in their positions for the past 2 years without a single rotation, which is simply unconscionable. Like, the humans are not built to live under constant and unending industrial bombardment for years and years at a time. It's simply not a thing that humans can deal with. You need to rotate these people. But the simple fact is that there's no one there.
Yeah, this discussion of mobilization has gone on hand in hand with demobilization, where, like you just said, a lot of these soldiers, if they go on leave, it might be to the nearest city for a weekend, maybe. And they have been fighting since the start of the war, a lot of them. A lot of them have been fighting since before the start of the war, with very few, if any, in some cases, breaks. And a lot of the idea that Zaluzhny especially has been emphasizing here is that a lot of the reason why more people are needed in the military is not just to, you know, replace losses or go on the offensive or anything like that, but literally just to rotate out people already there, to allow people to leave the military either for good or at least for extended periods of time. Give them, you know, a couple of months to not be a soldier, to go home, see their families, etc., which is very, very difficult to do. And at the moment, very contingent on whatever the needs of your individual unit may be. Which means that some people get more opportunities and some people get less opportunities. There more people are needed to fill in the gaps.
This entire kind of kerfluffle, I guess, has led kind of or has kind of crystallized in this fight to remove an MP who is slash was sitting on the National Security Commission. And I say is slash was because it is not clear whether she is still in on the commission or not. This is MP Mariana Bajula. She was slash is the deputy head of the Committee on National Security. And as you can imagine, is incredibly involved in drafting and redrafting these mobilization bills that keep coming up. And her story starts a little prior to the introduction of the first bill on mobilization, where she began to very actively criticize Zaluzhny in the media. She claimed that he had not presented the committee with a concrete plan for 2024. She was said to be part of a group of MPs looking for Zaluzhny's removal, with the rumor mill being that she was acting on behalf of the Zelensky administration in this. Whatever the case may be, the head of the committee attempted to remove her in a vote without her presence, obviously, around the new year. And while that vote passed in committee, it turns out that for a MP to be removed from a committee leadership position, that removal has to be approved by the parliament as a whole. A second vote has now been held to remove her, and it has failed. So Parliament is incredibly split on not only the mobilization issue, but even basic personnel management when it comes to military matters. It's not clear whether she will be removed. It's not clear how much authority she has in the committee. It's not clear whether these things can even possibly be resolved, given that alliances and coalitions on this matter keep changing. She has been both criticized and defended by members of her party. She is part of the ruling Servant of the People Party. She has been criticized and defended by opposition MPs. The whole thing's a giant mess, to be honest.
Yeah, I do think it is clear that Mariana is being used as a scapegoat for this. When Parliament announced these conscription bills, really plural, like the one big one, and then a bunch of other people were proposing their own solutions, none of them went well. And there was an immense amount of public outrage. There was a ton of complaints from within the military, not just rank and file, but like the higher command of the Ukrainian military and security forces, all with varying levels of distance, criticized this as being a terrible idea, as Zaluzhny and Merov. They all criticized it in one form or another, to which point the parliament had to say that, you know, we are the civilian government and make the decisions, which, while true, it'd be nice if, you know, taken into account the people actually affected by this. So to say that people were mad at Servant of the People Party and Parliament as a whole for these terrible, terrible proposals, and someone has to take the fall for it. Mariana was chosen, essentially, because, of course, she was a key part of it. But it's a good way for Parliament right now to basically dodge the responsibility for being so bad at their jobs. And I really like to say that, in general, the Verkhovna Rada is really bad at writing bills. It is often the case that a very important piece of legislation in its initial format is absolute garbage, not only in its direct effects, but also in just the language used to write it. They're not good at writing bills. And it is not until as time goes on that they kind of hammer it out into something that actually works and people are okay with. That is the general flow of how Ukrainian parliamentary politics works, how a bill becomes a law. But in this case, that has such large and very immediate ramifications, it's not something they can play around with. And so they're very defensive about that and trying to kind of defend their prerogatives, defend their usual process of doing things. And it can't be done anymore.
There is absolutely consensus that the conscription system needs to be reformed. But again, no one wants to touch it because no one wants to be yelled at by some crying grandmother that you sent her grandson off to die. that the political angle is absolutely taking the majority share here in considerations on this bill beyond just the body itself. Even if the bill was somehow perfect, for whatever value of perfect you would favor, would still be this highly politicized issue because there's no way around it. Ultimately, at the end of the day, the bill will send some kids to die and other kids to not die. And if you're the guy who signed the paper that sent someone kids to die, that's something you not only have to live with from a political standpoint, it's something you will always be attacked on for the rest of your political career, regardless of whether it was a necessary or unavoidable decision or not. And that when you add on the typical Ukrainian politicking on top of that, the notion just becomes untenable. Again, ultimately, they will pass some sort of conscription reform. What that will look like is unknown. Whether it's even going to resemble any of the proposals made so far, again, also unknown, but it will be passed sooner or later.
And undergirding all this, there are deeper societal, cultural issues at stake here. We have been seeing more of a societal divide between soldiers, volunteers, aid workers, and people who are less involved, less directly involved with the war. Where some feel that, you know, people far away from the front lines are living their normal lives and that they shouldn't be while their countrymen and friends and family are fighting. Is this entirely fair? I don't want to say so, but it's not really my place to cast judgment either way. I don't feel that way, but I mean, I've been to the front, but I'm not subject to conscription. I'm not fighting, so it's hard for me to form an opinion in that direction. Obviously, you know, I'm biased in that I do live more normally than they do by a pretty significant margin, and. But it's not just about me, of course. That's just my, you know, positionality here.
Luckily, as a Ukrainian, I can have an actual opinion on this matter. And I can tell you that absolutely the Ukrainian society is not, especially in Kyiv, the moment Russian troops withdrew from Kyiv Oblast and Kyiv itself was not directly threatened, there was a very strong desire and movement to normalize life again. Most of the time, besides the air raid sirens, which ebb and flow, you can live basically a normal life. Anecdotally, I've heard dozens of stories about conscription-aged men who are either attempting to dodge their draft notices, buying exemptions, or simply trying to flee the country or hiding. It's a harsh truth, but that's the way I see it. People simply do not want to fight. I was at my barbershop a few days ago, and his argument was that Ukraine has 1.5 million police officers. Mobilize 500,000 of those. Why are you going to the civilians and asking them to fight when there are 1.5 million cops on the streets? Send them to war. Obviously, like, it's a funny suggestion. I think it's also widely shared by a lot of people, but it's utterly ridiculous from my standpoint, simply because this isn't a lot of Ukrainians got used to the ATO, the Donbas conflict. They got used to, well, in this part of the country, we are like sitting in trenches and fighting Russia. And that doesn't touch anything else. It was one of the most common complaints you'd hear. From veterans of the Donbas conflict, when they come back to Kyiv, they're like, it's not just the West that doesn't care about us. No one in Kyiv gives a shit about us either. And I'm afraid that this kind of tendency is reasserting itself. The front is far away. And mind you, it's not that far away. It's really not that far away. But people would prefer to act as if it is, for, I think, obvious reasons. But this attitude needs to change. Like, we can't rely on Kyiv being threatened by Russian soldiers, and I'd rather not Kyiv be directly threatened by a physical Russian invasion. I'd like to stop things before they get to that point. But in order to do this, it's simply a fact that a lot more people are going to have to fight, and you can't just throw 500,000 cops at the problem. That's not how full-scale war works.
Yeah, so like I said, this is really an issue that's undergirding this, in that there is the immediate demand for more soldiers, like I said, for troop rotation purposes, if nothing else, but also the deeper issue of the army cannot be left on its own. There have been some proposals tossed around of, well, as part of mobilization, can we have some people take part in various volunteer activities as part, you're mobilized to, you know, put together med kits to do basic logistic stuff behind front line of driving, you know, a truck full of tourniquets to a hospital closer to the front line, you know, not direct military stuff, but home front type things. I've seen that suggested as part of the package of mobilization, because not only is it, and all that stuff, of course, very needed as well, but it also solves the issue of actually engaging more of society with the war effort. And I don't want to make it sound like society isn't engaged with the war effort, but there's a very high level of volunteer participation. There's a very high level of people donating their paychecks to various causes and for refugees, taking in refugees. In fact, my neighborhood groups, like my neighborhood Facebook group, is always, you know, raising money for different causes and trying to help out. This family of refugee just came in from Kherson. What can we do to help them? I do not want to make it sound like there's no engagement. However, that problem is starting to rear its head. And given another year of not many things changing, which seems to be the main prediction that most people are making, if that problem is allowed to grow and fester, that is an existential threat to Ukraine as a whole. So this is going to be a huge theme coming weeks. We're looking at the short term of what is happening with these bills, in the medium term of how these various problems will be looked at and addressed, and of course the long term of Ukrainians asking each other, what did you do during the war? So we'll be moving on from here to two more shorter stories. One of them, we're going to gaze back at Russia, which is that in the Republic of Bashkortostan, it is a ethnic Turkic republic within Russia, close to Tatarstan, in the area kind of between the Volga River and the Ural Mountains. So the long-term issue that has been going on in the Republic of Bashkortostan is, in Bashkortostan, there is Mount Kushtau. It has a lot of cultural relevance for the Bashkort people. I've heard some people describe it as like a holy mountain kind of situation, kind of like, you know, the Black Hills in the U.S. to the Lakota people. And there has been for the last several years, a debate around mining this mountain for chalk, which anyone with any sense of why that might be a sensitive topic to take a very, like, almost sacred location and instead turn it into a chalk quarry makes a lot of the locals very, very mad.
Mind you, chalk is not really that rare of mineral. You can find a lot of it in a lot of places. You really don't need to go into a holy mountain to mine chalk. You really don't.
There is this Bashkortostan soda company that's attached to the head of the republic that is going to be benefiting from this. So this particular project will be going in eventually into the pocket of the head of the republic. So, you know, it's not very hard to figure out what's going on here. It's just making this one particular guy money so he can then pay off his bribes to Putin and the rest of the system. That is how Russia works. Just a series of bribes going upwards. So this issue has been ongoing for a while. Some of the protests against it have been led by a Bashkort kind of cultural figure, Fayal Alisnyov. I am probably pronouncing that horribly. I do not know very well. But he is a figure that has been promoting, you know, Bashkort language, Bashkort culture to protect them from the overall effects of Russification, in addition to wanting to protect this particular mountain. Well, he was arrested a couple days ago, and there have been a lot of protests since then, especially in this one town called Baymak. Now, these protests have not been especially large, a couple of thousand people at a time. Well, by mock standards, it's not a very large city. 2,000 people is a lot of people, but, you know, in the overall scheme of things, 2,000 is not very many. So a couple of thousand people in each of these protests. There's been several of them. There is some politicking going on behind the scenes to have him released? It's really hard to kind of trace these issues going on in Russia, especially considering the fact that, well, neither of us know the publics especially well there. However, it does highlight some problems going on in that the actual resistance within Russia, as we've been seeing time and time again, has been coming from these ethnic minorities, and in many cases dealing with issues of protecting themselves from Russification or conscription. These have been the two main topics that have been going on in these ethnic minority regions, especially because ethnic minorities tend to be conscripted at much higher rates than ethnic Russians. The other issue going on here is that it has been a bit harder for Russia to do real crackdowns. So this has been going on kind of long time, considering the number of people involved. Part of it is that they don't want this to boil over even more than it already will. But also, Russia has limited resource for riot cops right now, especially since there was another large-scale deployment of Ravskaria to the Kherson and Zaporizhia regions in particular to deal with the large amount of partisan activity, killing Russian soldiers, blowing up bridges, that kind of thing. So the already limited resource of riot cops, several thousand of them were just sent to Ukraine and can't be used in Russia because of that. So this story has been evolving. We don't really know what's going to be looking at right now, if this guy will be free, if this mountain will be protected or not.
I mean, it's Russia. We can probably hazard a rather plausible guess.
Yes, but people do have to kind of cut deals. And if there's enough outrage within Bashkortostan, then that will mean that the head of the Republic of Bashkortostan may have to kind of not keep his people too mad at him at once, because
he'll just be replaced and a new head will be. Like, the governors of all of these areas are appointed by the Kremlin. They're satraps. They're not accountable to the populations that they rule.
But even then, if they're causing too many problems locally, they'll be replaced just so the feds don't have to deal with it. I'm not exactly very hopeful for this, of course, but I'm just giving some of the potentialities that could happen. We, of course, last year saw big protests in Dagestan that were pretty much put down brutally very immediately. But what resistance is happening in Russia is happening, again, in these ethnic regions. So, all of our topics here are just saying keep an eye on that, but keep an eye on this as well.
At the very least, it shows that it demonstrates an avenue for pro-Ukrainian sentiment to spread, and it's not amongst the ethnic Russians that various Western intellectuals would have you believe are some mystical and mysterious and dark-souled, whatever the hell. But with the very real minorities that have been very really repressed and oppressed and genocided for centuries by the Russian state.
And if not, you know, direct cooperation with Ukraine, which I don't think there's a huge chance of that becoming a very big potentiality. But the more friction happens in Russia, the better in general. So we'll be topping off on with some good news to leave you with, and that is on January 3rd, there was the largest release of Ukrainian prisoners of war, I think of the entire war. I think it might be the largest one thus far, and especially the only large organized prisoner exchange since the fall, when Russia had just ceased all talks in order to do prisoner exchanges. So in this gap of time between about August and December, there was a lot of theorizing of why Russia may be doing this, that they want no soldiers to think that the Ukrainian government will not return them home. They did a lot of things like having Ukrainian soldiers call their friends and family back home and say, pressure the government to get me home, like Zelensky is keeping me here, etc., that kind of thing. And of course, never actually trust what a soldier says when he's in captivity and being told to give a propaganda statement, but no one's really holding them to that. But this large-scale prisoner exchange happened. About 230 Ukrainians, most of them soldiers, but also I think about a dozen Ukrainian civilians were also being held captive by the Russians and were part of this exchange. A lot of these soldiers were defenders of Mariupol, of Snake Island. There was one guy who was actually at the border crossing between mainland Ukraine and Crimea that very first night of the invasion. So among the first prisoners taken in the full-scale war, he was returned home. There was a lot of stories of the various people who were released. One uplifting story was of Helena Fedushin. She was the only Ukrainian female Marine who was still in captivity. She was a defender of Mariupol. She was at the Ilin Metallurgy. She was at Azovstal, where she was captured with the rest of her Marine unit when they surrendered Azovstal to the Russians, and had been in captivity this entire time since then. And after being released, she ended up getting married to her fellow Marine, Mykola Gretsinyak, her comrade at Azovstal, who had been with her this entire time in captivity, and they got their, we can call it a fairy tale ending. Fairy tales are usually pretty grotesque up until the very end, unless it's a grim fairy tale, and that's pretty bad at the end as well. But fairy tale ending in the fact that, you know, they came together, they found love, and went through all that together. It's a very, you know, uplifting, romantic story to it. There are others, so many people whose stories have been passed around social media and the Ukrainian media, and it's good to see them come home.
Hopefully, we can look forward to more prisoner exchanges in the future, though the Russians have been, according to Ukraine's human rights ombudsman Dmytro Lubinets, the Russian side has been dragging their feet on the matter because, according to him, quite a number of their POWs are former convicts, and they don't want them back.
Yeah, that had been confirmed with this prisoner exchange as well, is that a considerable percentage of the Russian soldiers part of this exchange were themselves convicts, just because a disproportionate number of the Russian soldiers who are taken are convicts because they're the ones sent on these suicidal attacks on Ukrainian lines where if they don't die, they get captured. So that accounts for a lot of the Russians in Ukrainian POW camps, and Russians don't especially care about those people very much, so they're not worth as much as bargaining chips.
But at the very least, we did get these 230 men and women back, and thank God they're home.
So with that, we'll be closing off this episode. Thank you all very much for listening. If you'd like to support Ukraine more broadly, go to our LinkedIn and find different charities and sources of information about Ukraine. Your support is needed now more than ever. Your political support especially is needed now more than ever. Put pressure on your congresspeople, especially if you're a Republican, and support Ukraine. Your party is not being very helpful at the moment. So if you could lobby them on our behalf, it's so incredibly vital. This is a political fight right now. It's about votes. It's about lobbying. It's about getting your voice heard. We need those bullets. We need those shells. We need those vehicles. If you'd like to support Ukraine Without Hype directly, you can go to our Patreon at patreon.com/UkraineWithoutHype and join one of our tiers of support, including joining our Discord server for any form of support. So thank you very much to all of our Patreon subscribers. Thank you very much to Deborah Grazer. The voices in my head are from Big Pharma, David Shepard, Giorgio, Ivana Kukratskaya, Michael Drucker, Anna Karen Person, Anonymous, Dennis Napalm, Devi, Dimitri Litvin, Etienne, James Burke, Jan, Yanara, Jenny Louise, Kevin Alberton, Marguerite, Michael Wickman, Mike Perrone, PLM, Shieldwall, Silas Frank, T. Bart, Vivek, Adam Poppenheimer, Ada McDowell, Alex Crochmal, Anastasia, Barbara, Captain Technical, Chris Bennington, Daniel Spring, David Wall, Emily Bavona, Grace Kraus, Had to Laugh, Jacob Hoem, James Wise, Jared Bradley, Jerd, Julia Lindsay, Laura DeLeon, Levy Grove, Marianne, Matt Miller, Melissa Kiselko, Anonymous, Noam Hart, Paul Bailey, Randy McNerlin, RDK, Sander Bongers, Sanjay, Scott Barry, Scott Gengris, Scott Tarkiuk, Steve Bien, Stuart Akers, Subtle Knife, Thomas Sobiek, Veronica, Victoria Leontineva, and Wandering Lens. Thank you all very much. So until next week, Slav Ukraini.
Heroim Slav.